I want to welcome all the DHS employees today. how many are here? The whole crowd of you. Bradley, holy cow, welcome. Recognizing former member Fran Bradley is here. I want to welcome you to the committee. We don't have a quorum yet, right? Spilled off one. Okay. We are going to make, and maybe I'll repeat this when the rest of the members come, we're going to attempt to do the impossible, which is nothing new for the job we have this session anyway. We're going to attempt to get through the change pages, the explanation for the commissioner and various testifiers, and fly over every change page today. That would be novel and unusual if we can accomplish it. The purpose of that is so we at least understand the theme and what changes were made. And then, members, we're going to the Department of Health will come back tomorrow and do the same thing. They have a much shorter thing, and then we're going to take up some human service questions that arise out of today, tomorrow. Are we covering health care access fund today, Commissioner?
We're addressing both.
Okay, does anybody have a sheet on that? Okay, that's a good. Members, there's going to be certain pages you want to ask questions about. I don't know if we have a menu scorecard, but I want to know what pages you want to know about, and then we'll go into some depth on those. I've sat through, this will be my 13th chance to have a droning kind of, situation where they, the good staff goes on about things that we're fully informed about. So at least that we'll focus our time. We could spend 2 weeks on this, and you'd still have questions. And so that's my effort to focus our questions and give ample time. We have half of next week available at least for more of this. And we'll go as long as we have to with visits back on questions you have. In my thinking that, just to summarize, do we have a quorum? Okay. I'll call us to order. Welcome again. In my mind, our new commissioner has been faced with a bit of a task. I met the new IT guy. He's been there for 6 days so far. He seems kind of like an interesting fellow. And so there's a lot of new faces, a lot of new view. Would she have had another month or so, there'd be some interesting, innovative ideas coming that weren't able to be thought of in time to get scored. And so this is just one way to do it. But I do want to caution the audience and those listening who have interest in these topics that some of these are going to be real. And this is not a drill. And there's and the target that I'll have is probably not going to be as only 680 million like this one is. If you thought that we were kidding about the budget and all that, we weren't. I have had a number of ideas brought to my office, but not nearly enough. And if you represent an area that spends a lot of money and has a lot of growth, you have to know that we're looking at how what we're buying for that money and what value there is. And is there some way to deliver the service better to get the same or better value out of that on behalf of the clients we serve? And so that is that. I'll just call you now. Hi.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It seems like we're missing 98 to 246. I took you seriously about looking up the pages we wanted questions, and I was interested in 181, or am I missing?
I don't know that.
So do we. We're just doing part of it today, I guess?
I don't know. Mr. Wall.
I have 92.
Okay, what we're going to go over today is a change page. We're going to go over the budget information, I would presume, just the overall, and then the change pages. And if there's unchanged opportunities you want to talk about, that's something different. Let me. You'll have the full book tomorrow. With all the pages.
Okay.
And Commissioner, just to remind you, maybe you're new in town here, but see, in the Plenty Administration had little books, and the Ventura had little tabs in their books. So we got a disc, and so we're all saving money, and we understand the frugality and appreciate that innovation on your part in trying to make every dollar go as far as it can. But tell Governor Ventura we liked his little tabs. They were kind of cool. Anyway, there's a little cartoon that I got off I'm Repson Thiessen's Facebook friend, and this cartoon came from Dilbert, and I thought people would appreciate that. So, Representative Schomacher would like to move the minutes. Any questions about those? All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? That's that. So if somehow we'll handle what pages you want to talk about, and if you're going to, like, not sleep tonight because there's just something you had to ask, I'm not going to... Oh, you can't have any? Sorry, you'll have to wake up tomorrow with your questions. So, anyway, now you know who runs the place. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Cindy Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and with me this afternoon is Deputy Commissioner Ann Barry. So, as I just want to give you kind of some a broad brush approach that we took to looking at the budget, and then leave it to the Deputy Commissioner and the assistants to kind of walk through the change pages for you. As you know, DHS accounts for over 30% of the general fund budget, over 40% of the budget overall. And, you know, 83% of our dollars go to health care, mostly for the elderly and the disabled. And that's before we even get to kids. So putting a budget together in these hard economic times has been very, very difficult for us. I know you understand that fully and better than most people. When we went through this, we tried to our overall approach was protect the core safety net, protect those who need our help the most. We also sought to protect individuals wherever possible. But we did that while also knowing we had to slow expenditure growth. With the growth in healthcare and the growth in human services, if we don't, particularly with healthcare, slow that growth, we're not going to have enough money in the long term to spend on the many things that we all would like to have it or to, you know, to put it to the purposes we want. So protecting the core safety net, slowing expenditure growth were uppermost in our minds, but trying to do both of those with fairness in mind and wherever we could with reform in mind. So let me just highlight a few of those items for us before I turn it over to other employees in the department. First, we really are seeking to reform the managed care purchasing for our health care programs. I asked George Hoffman, who I know is familiar to many of you, to tell me how much we'd spent on managed care, and he said state spending on managed care as a method of purchasing health care is growing at a rate of over 12% a year if you look at it between 2003 and projected to 2013. I mean, we have to get that under control. As you said, Mr. Chair, I've been in the job, I think, about a month now, so I didn't. This was our first approach to this, but we knew we could not continue matters as usual. So our proposal is to reduce administrative costs to what will be the lowest in the nation. That's kind of looking back at how we've done or doing things currently. So we're also trying to change the way we do managed care purchasing. We're introducing a pilot in the metro area in the governor's budget to introduce competitive bidding for the managed care companies. We're also trying to improve outcomes through payment reforms, through reducing hospital admissions, through some pay-for-performance initiatives. If you look in the budget, what you'll see is that there is, in addition to kind of some of those items, like the competitive bidding item, the hospital readmissions item, you'll see that there is an across-the-board cut of 2.75% to the non-administrative side. So I said we lowered the administrative, but we also have a across-the-board cut of 2.75%. And I put that in there hoping that we do not have to do that ever, because I think I've tried to reach out to the providers, to payors, and say what we are inviting is truly to change the way we pay for health care. Give me your best ideas. Give all of us your best ideas. Is it direct contracting with providers? Is it changing our current managed care contracts? Is it a variety of those things so that we get the still quality health care but the payment reduction we need? But if you don't, then we will do the across-the-board cut. So this was probably our opportunity to say we may not have all of the best ideas right now, but give us more so that we can get to some targets that will start to not only slow the growth in this biennium, but give us some ways to manage the growth while maintaining quality in the long term. Let me just move quickly to talking to our approach. We certainly wanted to protect access to health care for people with the lowest incomes. In the governor's budget, we do continue coverage for children and all adults with incomes below 200% of the poverty level, but we are proposing to eliminate Minnesota Care coverage for adults with incomes above 200% of poverty. And I will tell you that is a really, really difficult decision for the department to make, the recommendation, and for the governor, and certainly for me. But once again, we are trying to protect those that with the deepest needs while curbing expenditures. This does put us in line for federal reform at the 200% level in 2014. And wherever possible, we tried not only to look at today, but what we would be consistent with where we think we need to be going forward. Another major thing in our budget was that we addressed was the need to manage the growth in our long-term care programs. These are some of the most important critical programs that we have at the department. Home and community-based services, nursing facilities, I mean, the list goes on. These serve very important folks, mostly our vulnerable people, elderly folks, individuals with disabilities, but they were growing at an annual rate of more than 8% a year. So in the budget, you will see ways that we tried to address kind of both the access piece by continuing the current caps on the disability waiver growth, establishing kind of medical needs thresholds, basically trying to target our dollars, and that includes it through some rate reductions to those that we believe need it most. We certainly sought in the budget to protect the core safety net programs that revolve around child protection and vulnerable adults. There are some county reductions in this budget, but we sought to protect mental health and basic child protection and adult protection functions wherever possible. The governor's budget proposes to fully fund adoption assistance so that we can ensure that abused and neglected children find permanent homes. We continue the general assistance, cash assistance. I know that's been a subject of debate in the past, but once again, we saw that as protecting the most vulnerable, those folks who don't have a number of lobbyists at the Capitol. And finally, and what I know is very hard, we asked our service delivery partners, our providers, who I must say we have a wonderful provider community for the most part in the state of Minnesota. We are so fortunate. Mm-hmm. But we are asking them for these next difficult 2 years to share this burden. And I, you know, we did prioritize wherever possible, you know, individuals. But I also know that at some point when you cut provider, rates, you are also impacting individuals. We are increasing the MA surcharges, as many of you know, because that captures federal dollars. We're doing that in a way that at least in the aggregate for the nursing facilities, ICFMRs, and managed care plans, they will, you know, get that be made whole. That is not the case with hospitals. I think hospitals get 44% to 48% of the rates in the aggregate back. We are reducing our home and community-based services rates, that's proposed in the governor's budget, as by 4.5% and nursing facility rates by 2%. These are proposed reductions that trouble us deeply, that we wish we did not have to propose. We built into the budget an assessment, a paid-for neutral assessment, to give the legislature and the department a read on how much this is impacting on the home and community-based services side, our enrollees' access to quality health care, because this, if it does too much, we may need to revisit that. Nursing facility rate reduction, once again, a very difficult thing. But as we were looking at fairness, we also noticed that they hadn't had rate reductions in the past several years, whereas a number of other providers have. We would hope not to have to do this, but, you know, given our need to equitably protect the safety net, we thought, and knowing what we do about nursing home rates, we thought this was possible. We're also delaying inpatient hospital rebasing as proposed in the governor's budget by 6 months. Those are just some of the highlights. None of this was easy. None of it was pleasant. I know you all understand that, as I said, better than most. At the department, from our perspective, we welcome ideas on how we can meet our goals of both preserving the safety net and curbing expenditures in a better way, in a more equitable way, we're open to hearing about it. This was the best way in this period of time that we could come up with.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate you coming. We're not going to take any questions of you, so you're free to go. Mr. Storkamp, do you want to come down? And I don't know if she's going to come second. We're just, they have to actually go solve some treatment needs of their clients. So you're done. So thanks. you get to go. Mr. Storkamp, and while he's coming, members, we've actually copied the first two pages of the packet. And this will be passed out by the pages. So the things you want to hear more about, please don't pick every one, unless you want to. And I guess that's fine, but that would kind of defeat the purpose. But there's things you want to know about, we'll go into that. If there's, we'll try to be responsive to that. Also, the back is blank. There's some room here to rate the actually different presenters, if you like, too, how they do. Mr. Storkamp, welcome to the committee. That was just a joke. And if you do the math on how many change pages are there, it's about one a minute or so. So we'll see how that goes. So, Mr. Storkamp, you can set the
pace. After the rating comment, I'm happy to go first.
And tell us what page you're on. I think you're on page 98. You are?
Page 98.
Thank you.
Is a change item for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I'm Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And on page 98, as we've talked to the committee last week, we talked about the growth in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And our change page really relates directly to that growth and strictly to that growth. It's based on an increase of 54 clients in fiscal year 12 and another 52 on top of that in fiscal year 13. And we have costs that are directly related to the growth. That covers treatment costs, security costs, and costs that are directly related to clients coming on board, such as food and so forth. That's actually averaged at $144 per day. So the calculation for our growth is actually fairly simple. It's the growth of 52, or the average number of days in that first fiscal year, by the $144, which is our overall, and we've got detailed breakdowns if the fiscal analyst would like to look at those pieces. So the total request for fiscal year 12 is $2.846 million, and the request for fiscal year 13 is $8.54 million,
okay,
for a total of $8.688 million. One note on that, the counties by statute pay 10% of that cost, and that cost will then come back to the general fund directly from the counties.
Perfect. That's the kind of overview we want. There's a text in each of these which members can read. Thanks. Ms. Berry, welcome. See, we're just moving along here. How long do you want to stay? Welcome to the committee, and who are you? And tell us all what you have to say.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ann Berry, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Human Services, and by your calculations, I should be here for 2 minutes because I have two change pages in front of me.
Cool.
First, on page 14. Is a recommendation for a net reduction of 3.5% per year to the department's general administrative accounts. That totals $3 million in general fund a year. I should also point out that there's a reduction in federal funds that come to the state because many of our programs are matched by federal funds, even in administrative programs. But the benefit to the general fund is a $3 million reduction a year against administrative accounts. The second change page in front of you starts on page 16. This is a continuation of previous proposals that have been in front of the legislature. It would continue to move us in the direction of covering the cost of our licensed programs by those who are regulated. So in this particular case, we would charge fees for the regulation of directly licensed programs that more closely resemble the actual costs of licensing those programs. That is an increase for a number of our directly licensed providers. We can provide detail about how those impacts look across the program areas, but there is a savings. The net fiscal impact is about $600,000 a year, $585,000 a year in reductions, and moves. Not only increases the fees, but moves these programs in the state government special revenue fund and off the general fund.
Well, thank you. That was very good. And just for members, the freshmen especially, the next two pages outline the detail of that. And thank you.
Next up, Aaron Sullivan.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for the 2 minutes. And if the Mr. Lights wants to sit next to her just to be ready when that time comes, that'd be great. Just good to look at him. So, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will start at page 21. As the commissioner indicated, these budget recommendations have been very difficult, and we've tried to protect services to core individuals, but there will be impact on counties, as she mentioned, that I will go through. On page 21 is a recommendation that the adoption assistance and relative custody assistance program budgets be adjusted to meet the current caseload as well as the projected caseload growth into the next biennium. The previous legislature did not fund the out years for this program. Adoption assistance, it provides financial assistance to adoptive parents who adopt children with special needs who've been in the foster care system primarily due to abuse and neglect. And the Relative Custody Assistance Program provides similar assistance to relatives who assume permanent legal responsibility for the for these children. And without this assistance, we would not be able to provide adoption assistance for special needs children. And this really does reflect the state's commitment to support families who adopt these special needs children. On page 23, it is a funding recommendation to fund the growth for the Minnesota Food Assistance Program. This food assistance program provides state-funded food support for legal non-citizens who do not qualify for federal food benefits because of their citizenship status. This program is available to eligible non-citizens who are 50 years of age or older. It is a fixed appropriation, and this recommendation would allow us simply to fund the current caseload, which averages about 300 a year.
Thank you.
The next several pages do deal with reductions to resources that would be available to counties as they administer programs that they have responsibility for. Page 25 is a recommendation to reduce the base funding for the Minnesota Family Investment Program Consolidated Fund. There's an interaction between this page and the last page in the packet that I will talk about briefly in a few moments. This reflects a 13.4% reduction to the base level of TANF funds available to this activity. Counties use these resources to provide a number of services to individuals who are transitioning from unemployment to gaining employment and maintaining employment, including work supports, emergency help with short-term non-recurring shelter, and other needs. The next page, page 26, is a recommendation to combine and restructure emergency general assistance and emergency Minnesota supplemental assistance. These are resources that are available for individuals who are otherwise eligible for general assistance or MSA. And it is funding that's available one time per year for emergency situations when people lack basic needs such as shelter or food, and that lack jeopardizes their health or safety. Reduced funds would be allocated to counties, and they would make decisions regarding distribution based on local need. We estimate that this combination would result in about 4,500 people fewer that being served in the next biennium than currently. Page 27 is another recommendation that would impact counties. This would eliminate the child support incentive grants to provide a general fund savings of about $6.71 million for the biennium. This would reduce the resources available to counties to support processing child support cases. I should mention that there is a 66% match on these funds, so to the extent that counties can maintain these activities with local resources, they would be able to avail themselves of those resources in the future. The next page is page 28, and this is a recommendation to end the state funding that currently goes to community action grants. Currently, we provide state funding for a statewide network of 28 nonprofit or public community action agencies and 11 tribal governments, which provide safety net supports and services to people in their communities. The community action agencies have responsibility for administration of a number of programs. They would continue to have some of those resources, but the state contribution would end. I should also mention that the president's budget also includes a 50% reduction at the federal level. The next item is page 29, This would be a recommendation to end a small program called the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota, which helps low-income people save money and have some capacity to invest in homeownership, starting businesses, or furthering their education, as well as helping them learn to be financially responsible. There is a federal match for every state dollar spent, but the recommendation, again, although difficult as it is, would be to eliminate this program. The next couple of pages are a number of recommendations regarding the Child Care Assistance Program. The governor recommends changes in the Child Care Assistance Program to simplify the program, to address program integrity, and to improve the quality of child care in unregulated child care settings. The net impact of the changes proposed would be $6.7 million in the next biennium. And I'll go over very quickly these changes. I expect that you will have more detailed questions later. The first three proposals have to do with reducing the cost of the Child Care Assistance Program and helping simplify administration for counties. The first would simply be to eliminate payments to child care providers for non-standard hours and payments for activity fees that would be effective in September of 2012. Currently, 55 counties allow for a non-standard differential, and we do provide for activity fee payments. The recommendation here, he would be to eliminate that. The second item is recommendation to limit the time an adult family member who is not in authorized activity may be temporarily absent from the home to 60 days. Currently, that the current policy allows for someone to be absent for an unlimited time period, and this would shorten that. The third item is to eliminate absent day payments for legally non-licensed family child care providers, and limit absent day payments to 10 days for calendar years for licensed providers and licensed exempt centers. And this would be effective January 1 of 2013. And there, you can see more detail there of the changes proposed, but for the sake of time, I will let you read that and let us know if you have questions. The fourth item would be changing and simplifying the way that we provide payments for activities that exceed the daily, weekly maximum rate for centers and licensed family providers, and limit payments to legally non-licensed providers to no more than 50 hours per week at the maximum hourly rate, or 10 hours per day at the maximum hourly rate, effective April 2012. You'll note the changing implementation dates here, and that is for to allow time for the need to ramp up and change our information systems to implement the changes that you may pass. The next couple of items have to do with program integrity, and we are proposing a couple of items to restrict payments of child care in situations that may result in improper payments being made in the program. The first is to prohibit child care payments to be provided by someone who to someone who resides in the same residence as the children, effective March of 2012. Many other states currently have this restriction as well. The second area would restrict child care payments for child care provided in the children's home, effective March of 2012. Currently, federal law allows us to pay for in-home care, but allows us also to establish some limits on its use. Currently, it's not restricted. This proposal would allow for payments for care in the child's own home only if the parent's qualifying activity occurs when out-of-home care is not available, or the family lives in an area that out-of-home care is not available, or the child has unique need or disability requiring in-home care. The third item does not have a fiscal impact, but would limit child care payments to centers that provide certain child care services for children who are the children of employees other than the parent of the child, or someone who lives with the child, effective in 2013. The next area, very quickly, has to do with increasing quality supports and trying to strengthen the quality of care provided to children in unlicensed setting. As you know, many of the most vulnerable children in our state are receiving care in unlicensed family providers that we are working to try to improve the quality. These are the same children we're also concerned about being ready for school when they hit that age. The proposal would add a requirement for family, friend, and neighbor providers, which are the unlicensed providers, to complete first aid and CPR training prior to approval. for receiving the public child care funds and a requirement that they register for training and participate in training for eight hours for every 2 years thereafter. This may result in some fewer providers, but we think it will improve quality. It will also simplify some of the documentation required at the county level. The next item has to do with the basic sliding child care assistance program. Traditionally, there is underspending in this program. The basic sliding fee program is available for low-income individuals or families who are not on our MFIT program. And this recommendation is to take $5 million of the unspent money for this year and send that back to the general fund. Typically, the unspent money goes into the next fiscal year, and this would be a one-time capture of the $5 million. The next item is a recommendation to increase the child support recovery cost from 1% to 2%, and this allows us to recover costs incurred in excess of any fees collected. This cost is applied to non-public assistance cases, and by increasing the recovery cost and doing some refinancing, we would be able to see a general fund savings into the next biennium. I should also mention that on the very last sentence at the bottom of the page before the chart, there's a typographical error. It says if the total cost for the programming required to implement the change is $9,000. That should read $90,000, and the state share is approximately $31,000. Moving right along to page 35, this is a recommendation to eliminate the carry forward balance that's in the account used for supplemental security interim assistance reimbursement to provide advocacy and outreach efforts to help people access SSI. In plain, simple terms, what this is people who apply for general assistance also are required to apply for SSI. For those that are eligible for SSI, the general fund, the funds are returned to the state. A portion of that goes to the general fund. The remainder comes back to the department to provide more outreach and advocacy for those individuals with disabilities who would be eligible. So this would be, again, a one-time capture of those funds. The next item is on page 36 is a recommendation to use existing state spending in the Child Care Assistance Program to leverage additional federal food stamp and employment funds to the state, and it would allow us to realize about $1 million in savings to the general fund for the next biennium. We currently do use some MFIP spending and child care assistance as a match, but we have the capacity to increase that match to to result in the savings that are proposed here. The last item that I have is a TANF refinancing. And this TANF refinancing goes with the first page, or the page that I mentioned, on with respect to the MFIP Consolidated Fund, and would be a refinancing of general fund money in TANF, and also, I should add, incorporates a recommendation from the Department of Health, a $20,000 per year TANF reduction in the budget for health that results from merging funding for TANF evaluations and training for American Indian tribes. I want to go back real quickly. I missed a very important page that I need to bring to your attention. On page 24 is another impact to counties. This is a recommendation that the what is currently the Children and Community Services Act funds be reduced by $10 million in 2012 and $12 million in 2013. And that the remaining funds be targeted to serve core functions to support vulnerable children and adults. This was the commissioner's comments earlier about trying to focus the remaining funds on core adult and child protection activities at the county level. I should also mention that this fund was reduced by the legislature in 2003. And again, this is another one of those difficult recommendations to make.
Thank you. I appreciate you scurrying through all that. And it dawned on me that if you're and the public, and I guess we're on TV today. Looks like the cameras are moving. A person could actually watch the whole presentation and kind of get the feel for what's going on. So thank you for that. And Mr. Lights, welcome to the committee. Oh, actually, there's an announcement, too. The in your packets, pages 59 to 65 are doubled. So the changes aren't twice as much. You just have two copies of them. So there's a copying error, so you have twice of those. Mr. Lights, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Scott Lights, Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at DHS. Mr. Chair, let me just echo the Commissioner's comments that these were all the very difficult decisions that are in the budget, and I'll go through about 27 pages for you. The first page, which starts on page 59, is a federal compliance issue. This is to implement program integrity audits for the Medicaid program. The Deficit Reduction Act, which was passed in 2005, and the Patient Protection Act, or Affordable Care Act, was passed in 2010. Both of those contained provisions to ensure that programs operated under Medicaid were done in ways that would prevent and reduce provider fraud, waste, and abuse. The budget item here is for implementation of those programs. Requests two FTEs to conduct the audits, as well as has some offsetting revenues from those efforts. Next page is page 61, coverage for dental therapists. 2009 legislature established a mid-level dental provider, two new types of mid-level dental providers, dental therapists and advanced dental therapists, who are able to do services that would traditionally have been delivered only by a dentist. Those programs have been started to operate. Graduates are coming out of those programs. This establishes two new the ability for provider types to be added to our system in order to reimburse those providers as they begin to do services on Medicaid clients. This has a net cost of about $120,000 that comes mainly from increased access to dental services that will be under these new types of providers. Mr. Chair, on page 62 is implementation of the Medical Assistance Electronic Health Records Initiative. The Federal ERA Act, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, provided funding through what is called the HITECH program for Medicaid providers and Medicare providers who to adopt and use electronic health records. Funding for the funds that will be that will flow as incentive payments to those providers are 100% federally funded. For Medicare, CMS will be administering that program. For Medicaid, Department of Human Services administers the program. What's being requested here is funding the 10%. This is funded at a 90-10 rate, so 90% federal, 10% state. What's being requested here is funding for the state portion of administering those grants to eligible providers in the community for adopting and using electronic health records.
Go on, you're doing great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, next item is on page 64. And this is funding to establish a streamlined eligibility determination system. The federal law at this point in time allows for enhanced funding for states to put in place streamlined eligibility systems and update their eligibility systems for the Medicaid program. It provides for 90% match through December of 2015 and 75% enhanced match after that time. Minnesota has two very antiquated systems right now, MAXIS and MMIS, that don't talk to each other very well. What this proposal will do will put in place a streamlined front-end eligibility system that will be able to make life much easier for the counties and for others as they do eligibility determination for our healthcare programs. I might add this will also interface well as we move towards implementation of a health insurance exchange in 2014. Next item is on page 65. This is a package of managed care reforms. Since 1985, Minnesota has used managed care organizations to deliver health care and long-term care services to our health plan enrollees. This is a package of a number of initiatives. The first is to establish a clinical performance target for reducing hospital readmission rates. in order for MCOs to receive their withhold payments. We currently do a withhold and then measure against the quality targets and pay back the withhold to HMOs if they meet those quality targets. This would be establishing a target of reducing hospital admissions by 5%, hospital readmissions, 30-day readmissions, by 5% per year over a series of years until the readmission rate is reduced by 25% compared to what it was in calendar year 2010. Second thing is to establish a competitive bidding pilot project in the Twin Cities area for managed care contracts for adults and children in the metro area. So this would be health plans bidding for PMAP business based on contracted prices. The third thing is to reduce the amount of capitation payments that managed care organizations can use for administrative expenses. There's currently a cap at 6.6%. This proposal brings that cap down to 5.3%. And then finally, the commissioner mentioned this in her opening comments. This is to reduce, the final item is reducing non-administrative payments to managed care organizations by 2.75%. The goal here is to actually use this opportunity to hopefully put in place some fairly serious system delivery reforms underneath the managed care plans to drive better value and higher quality outcomes. Next item is page 67, evidence-based childbirth program. This is an incentive program that would be created for hospitals to develop policies and quality programs to eliminate elective inductions of labor before 39 weeks of gestation. We have seen induction rates triple over the past 20 years. They're very high. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists has recommended that elective inductions not be performed before that time. This puts in place a program of incentives at a hospital level from a policy perspective to start to reverse that trend to put in place policies to eliminate those inductions before 39 weeks.
Kind of strange just flying through, isn't it there, Mr. Lights? There's 100 questions, but we're holding all of them. So
we appreciate that at this point in time. Next item is page 69, rehabilitation service coverage and PA changes, our prior authorization system. This proposal makes a number of changes to the prior authorization system for healthcare services. It also modifies coverage for certain therapies. Specifically, as is listed here, it modernizes the PA system in order to improve our program oversight. Effective July 1st, 2011, special maintenance therapy, or SMT, will no longer be covered by our healthcare programs. March 1st, 2012, all providers except those requesting authorization for out-of-state services must submit authorizations electronically through what's called our minutes system. At DHS, and then effective March 1st, 2012, rehab services, physical therapy, OT, and speech-language pathology will no longer be subject to one-time service withholds, but instead will require prior authorization for an episode of treatment. And that results in a savings overall from that package of about a little over $1 million over the biennium in the general fund. Mr. Chair, the next page is page 72. This is a proposal to modify communication device pricing. A number of our clients covered in healthcare programs have a variety of conditions like cerebral palsy, MS, autism, strokes that require them to use devices that helps to compensate for their impairment or disability. Those devices we're proposing to modify the way that we pay for those by paying them at the lower of a submitted charge, the MSRP, manufacturer suggested retail price, minus 20%, or an invoice price plus 20% for non-manufacturers or vendors enrolled in our programs. We currently pay those at MSRP currently. So this results in savings of a little over $300,000 over the biennium. Next page is page 73. This is to modify our pharmacy reimbursement methodology. We currently pay pharmacy at average wholesale price, or AWP, minus 15%. The change here is necessary because the data source that we use for AWP won't be available to the department after September of 2011. Instead, we'll be moving to the wholesale acquisition cost, or the WAC, and it will be, acquisition costs will be estimated at a WAC plus 2%. So instead of doing AWP minus 15, we'll be doing WAC plus 2. It's essentially the same price, Mr. Chair.
And it saves money. Did you do page 71, which is the third party liability?
I didn't.
Okay. Is that yours?
Thank you for your for noting that. The page 71 is to modify our third party liability process. Under federal and state law, Mr. Chair, the healthcare programs that we run are payers of last resort. What this proposal does is to require providers to secure a determination of authorization or payment from third-party payers prior to requesting authorization for payments from our healthcare programs. And in a sense, there are a number of cases where the enrollee in our programs is covered by other coverage, and therefore, as a payer of last resort, we should actually be collecting from those parties first, and so this authorizes those providers to actually seek that authorization prior to coming to us for payment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next item is page 75. This is modification to our critical access dental payments. There were some changes made to the critical access dental program last legislative session. One of the changes that we're seeking clarification on is that the current statute specifies that clinics that are associated with the University of Minnesota, or MINSCU, can be designated as critical access dental providers. This clarification goes further to clarify that only clinics that are actually owned by the University of Minnesota, or MINSCU, can be operated or designated as critical access dental providers. It also reduces the add-on payment for Minnesota Care for critical access dental payers from 50% to 30%. That brings Minnesota Care in line with what we do currently under the medical assistance program, so it aligns those two. Next item is page 76, Mr. Chair. Payment of Medicare crossover claims. For our dually eligible populations, it's a complex series of things. Basically, what we're doing here, Mr. Chair, and we can come back and answer questions on this when you're taking further questions on it, but to keep the conversation relatively short, what this is doing is capping the amount that we pay for claims for dually eligible folks that we typically would now pay at a Medicare rate, paying it at ensuring that we don't pay any more than the Medicaid rate for those. Medicaid typically pays more than Medicare. This merely makes that change to ensure that we don't pay any more than Medicaid. Page 77 is the next item. We currently in our healthcare programs provide incentive payments to managed care companies that expand preventive services. And essentially this is a payment up front that's intended to reimburse the managed care plans for a portion of the cost for the services that they're doing. We catch up later in the capitation rate, but this sort of fronts the cost for it. We're proposing to suspend those payments for a couple of years, resulting in a savings of a little over $1.5 million over the biennium. Page 78 is a proposal to impose a 0.5% rateable reduction for what are called basic care services. To let you know what's included in basic care, it would be things such as outpatient hospital, therapy services, vision care, DME, medical supply, ambulatory surgery, and lab services, among a number of other things. What this wouldn't impact are things like pharmacy, dental, inpatient hospital, mental health, or physician services. The 0.5% rateable reduction results in a savings of a little over $2.6 billion over the biennium. The next proposal on page 79 is to reduce rates for transportation services. Medicaid provides certain transportation services for clients to receive to be able to go to see healthcare providers. This would do a 4.5% ratable reduction for transportation services, including ambulance, special transportation services, and access transportation services. The costs in this program, I might just add, have gone up. Fee-for-service reimbursement for these types of services have increased about 31% between 2003 and 2008, and we've generally not done reductions to these services prior to this time. So this proposal will do proposes a reduction of about a 4.5% ratable on those rates. The next proposal is on page 80. And this proposal recommends freezing the rates that we pay for child and teen checkup screenings in our programs at their current rate. The way this program is structured, the rate that we pay for these services typically increases each year as it's set at the 75th percentile of charges, and as charges increase, the rates increase. We have had increases of about 41% in these rates over the course of 2003 through 2008. What we're proposing here would be to freeze them at current levels. We believe access will still be maintained at their current levels because of the previous increases. Mr. Chair, next item is on page 81. This would be a proposal that the commissioner mentioned earlier to delay inpatient hospital rebasing. State law requires hospitals to be rebased every other year. Basically, it brings their rates up to up for inflation. The last two rounds of that in 09 and 10 and 11 were delayed. We're proposing to delay for a further 6 months, resulting in a savings of close to $100 million in fiscal year 2013. Next item is on page 82. Currently, the state administers the Medical Education Research Cost Fund. Part of the funding, a large portion of the funding for that program, which supports trainees at training institutions around the state, comes from a carve-out of capitation rates that are then transferred to the health department for payment down to the training sites. What the governor's proposal here is to use actually take a portion of that, about half of that, and cut the portion that's transferred by about half. Mr. Chair, next is page 83, which is a medical assistance surcharge and payment rate increase. The governor is recommending that the current medical MA surcharge rate, which is 1.56% and has been in place since 1994, so it's been in place and frozen at that period for a long period of time, be increased to 4.5%, or 4.45%, I should say, effective July 1st of 2011. A portion of that will then be used to pay for increased rate increases for hospitals on the inpatient side. The increases would be start from July 1st of 2011 to September 30th of 2012, a 24% increase in inpatient rates, and from October of 2012 through September of 2013, an 18.5% increase in inpatient hospital rates. In essence, this pays back about 44% of the increased surcharge that goes back to hospitals.
We'll have questions about that a little later.
Understand, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
The next page is page 84. It's a managed care surcharge. This increases the current 0.6% medical assistance surcharge on HMOs up to 4.3%. It also implements a 4.3% surcharge on county-based purchasing plans. Both of those are effective July of 2011. We're recommending, in addition, that we increase payment rates to managed care organizations for the work that they do under medical assistance in Minnesota Care, effective January of 2012. Those rate increases are approximately close to 9% for HMOs from January of 2012 to July of 2012, and then the rate increase starting July of 2012 is 3.7%. For county-based purchasing entities, that rate is increased from 10.32% from January of 2012 through June of 2012, and then starting in July of 2012, that rate increases 4.3%. In the aggregate, Mr. Chair, this will repay the amount of the surcharge back to the HMOs through capitation rates about a little over 80% of that. On page 85 is another proposal the commissioner mentioned in her opening remarks. This proposal would end Minnesota Care eligibility for adults above 200% of poverty, starting in January of 2012 for adults without children and January 2012 for adults in families with children. The current income levels for these programs are 250% of poverty for adults without children, and for adults and families with children, it's 275% of poverty or $50,000 of annual gross income. Mr. Chair, there's a series of the next series on pages 86, 87, and 88, and 89, and 90 all relate to eligibility changes that had been approved by the legislature but not yet implemented because we had not yet received federal approval for these changes. I can go through those, Mr. Chair, at a fairly high level if that would be useful. But essentially, they're all going to be doing, they're going to be changes to programs that were intended to bring increased access. They were not federally approved and or have yet not yet been. So we're bringing those forward for recommendations for.
Yeah, approval. Just to the high level, you're doing very well.
The first is to repeal the MA Bridge program for children. This was. The legislature in 07 and 08 expanded MA and Minnesota Care by extending MA eligibility for two additional months for kids aged between ages 2 and 18 whose income exceeded 150% of poverty. They were also granted automatic Minnesota Care eligibility until their next renewal. The original intent really was to reduce delays in Minnesota Care eligibility determination that came about from the counties transferring case files to the state. And then eligibility being determined. We've actually reduced the eligibility determinations time a lot over this time period, so the need for this isn't as high as it once was. The next proposal, which is on page 87, is to repeal the rolling and grace month eligibility periods. These changes, Mr. Chair. Grace Month gives a person an extra month to pay premiums without being disenrolled from our Minnesota Care program. And the rolling month gives a person an additional month to submit renewal forms. These were intended to provide some additional cushion for people who either missed a payment or who did not submit renewal forms. Again, these have not yet been approved by the federal government, and we're proposing to repeal those pieces. Next item is on page 89, actually. These would repeal some unapproved Minnesota Care changes that were also put in place over the course of the past several years. The first is to repeal the exemption from the income limit for children. There's a few children who exceed the income limit and pay the maximum premium on Minnesota Care. The state law that has not yet been approved would allow those children to remain on the program. We're proposing to repeal that. We also repeal the exemption from cancellation for certain renewal for certain children, and then to repeal automatic Minnesota Care eligibility for certain children in foster care. The next item is on page 92. This is federal compliance with federal compliance with eligibility changes. The Affordable Care Act, as well as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, prevented states from implementing more stringent eligibility standards than existed either on July 1st of 2008 or March 23rd of 2010, depending on which act it was. These recommendations really are intended to ensure that we're not out of compliance with those maintenance of effort requirements that are in those two federal acts. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, on page 93 is a proposal. The 2010 legislature enacted several transfers from the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund. to ensure solvency of the Health Care Access Fund, this proposal reverses a number of those transfers.
We like solvency. Is that the end of your presentation?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you for flying through those, and this is a record-setting pace, but I think it's a good trend run. So I guess you can go when you like, and then Ms. O'Connell, welcome to the committee, and thanks for sharing your information.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the new Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services. And since this is only day 8 for me, I'm really happy you're not asking me any questions today. And I think I will be able to fly through my 4 pages in 4 minutes or less. The first proposal on page 94 tightens placement criteria for admission into residential chemical dependency treatment programs in order to ensure the appropriate use of this more intensive level of service. There's a general fund savings of $9 million projected for the biennium. As a result of this policy change, there will be about 1,900 placements to outpatient chemical dependency treatment each year that would have otherwise been served in residential settings. The next proposal is on page 94. And this proposal increases the county share of chemical dependency treatment costs. There's a general fund savings of approximately $9.4 million projected, and the county share of non-federal treatment costs is currently set at 16.14%, and this would increase that to 22.95% for those clients that are not enrolled in medical assistance. The third proposal is on page 96, and this is a proposal to reduce state-operated services. And the proposal is to close the Community Behavioral Health Hospital in Willmar. It proposes to move the inpatient child and adolescent behavioral health services from the former Willmar Regional Treatment Center campus to the vacated Community Behavioral Health Hospital site in Willmar. And I'm sure I'll be back to talk more about that. The fourth proposal is actually budget neutral, and this is a proposal to extend coverage for tribal child placements. This proposal is creating an authority to fully implement legislation adopted in 2010 that allows for American Indian tribes to receive 100% federal Medicaid reimbursement for children's mental health residential treatment services. The 2010 legislation created the authority for a tribe to determine the appropriate level of care for an Indian child when Indian health service funds or tribal health funds are being used to pay for children's mental health residential care.
Thank you.
Is that it?
That's it? Well, I'm sure we'll see you again. So thank you and good luck on your new position.
Thank you.
Mr. Coleman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I've stopped counting how many days I've been.
Oh, yeah, we don't.
At
some questions we don't want to ask.
But I'm still enjoying it. So
seems like yesterday, Mr. Cole.
Yes. We have a number of recommendations that we will talk about that impact the long-term care system. Let me, for brevity, I'll just say we are proud of our long-term care system in Minnesota, and we want to continue to work with our providers and partners to maintain that as best we can, but we're obligated to try to slow the growth of the programs in Minnesota. I'll begin on page 39. The first proposal is to eliminate the 2009 1% acuity factor that was added to the developmental disability waiver. We had deferred that, and now we are proposing to eliminate that one-year-only payment into the county budgets. They've adjusted their budgets to attempt to meet the needs of the people in the program, and this is a one-time decision. On page 40, also a continuation of a strategy that has been used before is to suspend funding for community service development grants for an additional 2 years that would otherwise be used for capital projects, renovation projects, and this would eliminate funding about $3.6 million each year. It still leaves about $2.2 million in the community service development fund for continued development of home and community-based services. On page 41, we move into a series of changes that we are recommending to the elderly waiver and alternative care program. I certainly won't try to address all of the elements in here in detail. Again, I suspect I'll be invited back to talk in more detail about a number of these programs, but there are a number of elements in here. The elderly waiver program is a fast-growing program, and there are a number of strategies embedded in this change page. The first is changing the definition of low need. We are proposing to expand the definition of case mix L. We have an acuity-based system in this program. L would expand that to up to two dependencies for non-critical activities of daily living. So there would be more people who would be classified in this lowest level of need. Additionally, the community-based budget amount would be reduced for case mix L individuals from $2,200 per month to $1,750 per month. And your pages do identify the number of people that we project to be impacted by these changes. Another significant part of the elderly waiver program is customized living and 24-hour customized living. And those are areas that are caring for those that are of higher needs, and we want to ensure that it continues to do so. And so there's a number of strategies within there to try to make sure that it does so. Most people refer to this service as assisted living. We in Minnesota use the term customized living. Again, we are proposing to reduce some expenditures, reduce some of the limits on what we are spending in this area. We're also reducing the component rates that make up this bundled service. We've moved to a rate-setting methodology in this program for customized living that is a accumulation of a number of very specific components, and on average we are proposing to reduce those components by 10%. That doesn't mean that each component would be reduced 10%, but we are trying to get some amount of economies of scale in this bundled service for medication setup, meal preparation, things of that nature in this congregate setting. Additionally, we are proposing to increase the criteria for 24-hour customized living. And again, trying to target our resources to make sure that we are able to take care of those individuals with the greatest needs. And so we are proposing to increase the criteria to require a dependency of at least three ADLs to receive 24-hour customized living. Many of those individuals would still be eligible for customized living, but not the 24-hour customized living. And then the additional component in here is, again, referencing the rate methodology tool that we're using to match a payment rate to the needs of the individual. We have the data about all the individuals in this program, and we do believe with some additional auditing functions, we could save some additional money to make sure that we are getting accurate data and that we are maximizing the Medicare program, making sure that Medicare is paying for services within this setting that is eligible by the beneficiaries in these settings. And I'm sure we will talk more about that program at a future date. Continuing on page 44, this is really unique to be able to go through this so fast.
Enjoy the moment.
I know it's only going to be for now. We get into, again, trying to manage our long-term care system, trying to make sure that we're targeting services to those with greater needs. Well, this is kind of the inverse. We're taking a look at low-need individuals in nursing facilities, and we are proposing to reduce the payment rate for those low-need individuals by 25%. I want to remind the committee that the nursing facility level of care that was enacted by the legislature a couple years ago has not been implemented because of federal maintenance of maintenance of effort requirements. These are the same people that otherwise will not be eligible for this service in 2014 if that nursing facility level of care is allowed to go forward as part of our system. So we're trying to help those individuals with the lowest needs receive the right amount of services and work with the providers and our partners to redefine how those individuals will be cared for. Some may leave nursing homes and move back out into the community at a lower cost. Similarly, on page 46, we are also recommending that reduce the cost of services for individuals as having lower needs that are currently living in corporate foster care or customized living settings, and within our CADI, our Community Alternative for Disabled Individuals, our DD, our Developmental Disability Waiver, and our Traumatic Brain Injury Waiver. Again, trying to make sure that we are able to develop, to deliver as much resource to those individuals with higher needs. And so, again, it's consistent with what we've been trying to do to manage our long-term care system growth and make sure that we're targeting resources to those with the higher needs. A number of people, about 3,600 individuals, will be impacted in the waivers. And again, we're trying to work with counties and the providers to not necessarily move those individuals, but to redefine their service package so that they can continue to receive services at this lower allocation. Page 48 is a topic that has come before the legislature for a number of years now, and that is to use one of our remaining tools of managing our growth in our disability waivers, and that's limiting the number of individuals who are able to enroll in our waivers. So we are recommending a limited number of slots be made available on an annual basis. The chart on page 48 gives you the history and the recommendation under this change page for the next 2 years. Page 50 is a proposal to de-link the growth in elderly waiver rate caps from nursing facility rates. The elderly waiver program, as I mentioned earlier, is growing, and it is one of those areas that we have an eye on for the coming years with the demographic pressures that we have and the increasing needs of older Minnesotans. In current law, the caps on this program automatically increase if the cost of nursing home care goes up. And we're proposing that we make a purposeful decision to provide additional growth in this program each legislative session to make sure that we are managing it as effectively as we can. So we're trying to make that a separate decision through the budgeting process. Page 51 is certainly a proposal that is substantial, and it is the provider rate reduction proposal. We are recommending a 4.5% rate reduction for home and community-based long-term care providers and aging and continuing care grants. Additionally, a 2% reduction in nursing facility rates for this budget page. I will get to some other impacts to nursing facilities shortly, which may explain some of the differences there. This is a substantial rate reduction, and we recognize that. And we don't do it with without some concerns. We want to make sure that we have a long-term care community that provides access to our consumers who need those services. And so within this proposal is also a small appropriation for us to secure an outside evaluator to make sure that these changes that we're making to the long-term care system are not disturbing access for our consumers in our communities to our long-term care programs. And so I want to highlight that because I know that's an administrative request and it always gets some attention. But we want to actively manage this reduction with our providers and our consumers, and we want the resources of an independent evaluation. As I mentioned, there are a number of non-rate reductions to nursing facilities that you will find on page 53. I'm sure we will talk in more detail about those at another date, but I'll rapidly go through those now. Because of the way we pay nursing facilities and the history and the origin, there are a number of rate add-ons that have been decided over the years. And this is a series of either eliminations or reductions to those rate add-ons. The first is to eliminate any additional or new plan closure rate adjustments for nursing facilities. Currently, we have paid them up to now to close beds, take them out of the system permanently, and try to meet some of those fixed costs as they change their bed complement or close completely. Additionally, there is a new single bed incentive that we have been paying facilities to encourage the development of single rooms. That would be eliminated additionally. We are also proposing that we reduce the enhanced rate for new admissions. We pay a enhanced rate above and beyond the case mix rate or the RUGS rate for the first stay or the first number of days that an individual enters a nursing facility, and we are reducing that enhanced rate for the first 30 days from 20% to 10%. We still want to encourage short stays. We still want to work with the providers to make sure that people who can return to the community are doing so. But this is a reduction in that rate add-on. We're also proposing to reduce bed hold payments. Not all facilities qualify for bed hold payments currently based upon their occupancy, based upon the criteria that are currently in play. We are proposing that we would reduce that 60% payment that it currently exists if somebody is out of the facility, if the consumer is not in the facility, reducing that 60% to 30% of the established payment rate, and increase the eligibility test from 93% occupancy to 96% occupancy. Those are some numbers that have changed over the years, and we're recommending that we reduce those further. And then we also have a provision in our current program that will pay for a single room for an individual on medical assistance who can demonstrate medical necessity. We will pay an 11.5% rate add-on. we're proposing that we reduce that to 5.5%. We still want to encourage people in our programs to receive a single room if it's medically necessary, but we are reducing that add-on payment to the rate. Continuing on page 54, Governor is recommending that we increase the surcharge that we apply to nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled. It's a mechanism that we have used for quite a number of years now. So this is recommending that we increase another $635 per year per bed to a nursing home effective July 1, an additional $350 per licensed bed effective October 1. We would increase the rates that we pay nursing facilities accordingly and apply that to the ongoing rates that we are paying on behalf of medical assistance individuals. Similarly, we would do a similar function to intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled, increase that surcharge on those two dates, and then increase the rate that we pay for those services accordingly. Most facilities will receive enough revenue in the increased rate with which to pay the surcharge. That's our projection. The impact, though, I will note, full disclosure, is upon private paying individuals who will see their rates increased by a feature called rate equalization, where facilities will increase the charges to private paying individuals. The last page that I have to present today is on 56, and this is a proposal to highlight employment, competitive employment for people with disabilities. It's a major strategy within our area to increase employment for people with disabilities. We've been participating in a federal program, the Pathways to Employment, which is demonstrating that with some additional supports, with some additional recognition of the health care costs of this population, employment can become an expectation, can become a reality. But health care is in a very important part of a person's life, and so we have a program in Minnesota that allows individuals to buy into our medical assistance health care. This would increase the premium that is charged in actually the next biennium as we get into the kind of the wind down of the Pathways to Employment program, and increase the unearned income obligation. Our research has shown that if people are given the proper incentives, and this being one of those, that people with disabilities will work, and they will actually work more. But we kind of take the question about health care out of this equation of, well, if I work more, am I going to jeopardize my health care benefits? And so it actually works to everyone's benefit. People have more income. They can pay more taxes. They can participate in the community. They can earn more Social Security credits. And we can generate some revenue to help offset some of the increased medical costs for this population. So it's a major strategy in managing longer term our services for people with disabilities. And that's the conclusion of our pages.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Just stay one second. Mr. Johnson and Ms. Oat want to come down. While they're coming, what percent of the surcharge is returned to the places? Do you know offhand? The other people mentioned their return. Do you know offhand, or is that something for later?
I don't. It varies by facility because right. Each facility is has a different payer mix. So it ranges from zero for facilities who don't participate in our medical assistance program, because the surcharge is a licensed bed surcharge. So if you don't participate, we don't pay them anything. So it would be zero to 100% for those who have high occupancy and high medical assistance. But most facilities will receive a sufficient amount of revenue based upon our current analysis of their occupancy and payer mix.
When you come back, I'll just like a rough net.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the easy pass you got today, and we'll have harder questions later for you.
Thank
this
you.
Vote, you can sit by Mr. Johnson there if you like. Now, this has gone very well, and I think if you're watching at home, you never saw the budget presented this fast in this concise of a manner. So kudos to the department for keeping on topic and for my members for being patient. You get to escape now if you want, Mr. Johnson, so take the chance. Coleman, I'm sorry. You can't go, Mr. Johnson. Sorry, you have to stay. We have 15 minutes left, and I want to spend that time looking at the global picture, if you can. And again, this is high level, but I believe the total number of adjustments to the forecast was $680 million on pieces, and then there's surcharge add-backs. And can you just help us with that? And then Ms. Vogt's going to talk about the Healthcare Access Fund. And so if you can fit that both into 15 minutes, it'll be a perfect day. So.
Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson, Chief Financial Officer for DHS. I can do a very brief overview of just breaking down the impact of the budget proposals you just heard. The total benefit to the state budget from all of what was just presented is just under $1.3 billion, $1.296 billion.
Is there a page of that anywhere?
If you have this spreadsheet, I think you may have in your packet, but I'm not positive.
No, we don't have that one. So.
Okay.
We'll have it for tomorrow.
We can get it for you. That's the total value to the state budget. About $1.1 billion of that is to the general fund and $190 million to the Healthcare Access Fund. You'll recall that Mr. Leitz presented a transfer page, so that's what affects the Healthcare Access Fund savings being larger here. About $612 million of that $1.3 billion is the value of the surcharges, the net value of the surcharges, the revenue that comes back to the state after we make the payouts on the rate increases that are part of the three surcharges, the two Mr. Leitz presented and the one that Mr. Coleman presented. And as you said, Mr. Chair, $684 million that remains is from the reductions that the Assistant Commissioner has just presented to you, offset by a few spending items as well that they presented. So the net effect for the state budget is $1.3 billion. That's about $684 million of spending reductions and $612 million from the surcharges.
And is the $684 include, so there'd be a, it'd be a, is that the net, including the buyback, the increased things?
Yes, that's correct.
So what's the gross amount of the buybacks? Would it be like, what, $20 million or $30 million or something?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to look at that more.
I'm just interested this in for my own planning purposes. So it's going to be a little over $700.
Mr. Chair,
Landing, I think, knows the answer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that this spreadsheet isn't at the end of our packet.
Oh, it is. Oh.
And so I think it'd be helpful if Mr. Johnson would refer and point out the numbers as you look at this.
Yeah, let's just find that. Do we have it? How'd you get it? I don't have it in mind. Oh, you have yours. Okay. I got one now. Here we go. Everybody have theirs? I may not have one. Thanks for being on. So, do you want to orient us to the, and so since we're orienting, just orient us to the sheet and we'll look at it and then ask you more questions.
The numbers that I was sharing were the totals on the top page of that spreadsheet for the 12-13 biennium, the $1.296 billion total benefit to the state's budget.
And then the other totals?
The other totals aren't that I gave you in terms of the breakdown from the surcharges and reductions, that's not, you can't find that without pulling those pieces out individually.
Okay, and then just for my purpose, you'll tell me the subtotal of reductions, and then there's things we bought some things in this budget.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Off. There were a handful of items, federal compliance,
right.
The adoption assistance forecast funding, that were spending items that are part of that 684 and offset to reductions otherwise.
So they would be Oh, they're part of the 684, or are they on top of the 684? So that's
no.
That's the highest.
The 684 is the net value of the reductions and the spending items.
So the total reductions would be over 700 then.
If you didn't do the spending items, that's
right.
Correct.
Okay, that's and I'm interested in that total just for my own purposes. So. And so, what else do you want to tell us about the global picture? Is that,
Mr. Chair, that's about what I can tell you about the global picture.
Okay. Well, I appreciate. I know this is. I mean, the ink's barely dry on these things. So let's do the Healthcare Access Fund, and then we'll have a few announcements, and then maybe a few moments for questions. You're first, Chair Representative Huntley. You'll be the first person. You want to ask your question now on the global picture? Please,
Mr. Chair, and
I'll move your microphone.
Mr. Johnson. So the total cuts to in the general fund to Health and Human Services is $1.1 billion.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, that's correct. That includes the surcharges as well.
So
Representative Huntley,
I'll just keep my mouth shut.
And I think that we're going to wonder about. We'll do the healthcare access, and then I just want to ask about the interaction of the surcharges, and that'll probably be about as far as we get today. Welcome, Ms. Vogt.
Thank you.
We have your handout. Everybody have the healthcare access fund handout? That's pretty good. For the viewers at home, we'll hold it up so they can get a little shot of it. Go ahead, Ms. Vogt. Welcome to the committee, and you just want to walk us, give us the couple-minute overview and what's the status at the end of 12 and 13 and so on.
Mr. Chair, my name is Angela Vogt. I'm an executive budget officer with the Minnesota Management and Budget Department. You have in front of you the Healthcare Access Fund balance that incorporates the governor's recommendations. You'll see, I guess the bottom line maybe most importantly, at the end of fiscal year 2013, the governor has balanced the fund with a small balance of about $2.5 million. How we get there is there's a couple sections in the balance that talk about proposed changes to different pieces of the fund, and so that's where you would see where the governor's recommendations are. One is a small transfer in of $2.8 million up in the top section. Down in the bottom section, you'll see a listing of the different governor's proposals that impact the Healthcare Access Fund. Most of them they all are ones that have been talked about and are included in DHS's budget proposal book. It's just that they cross over between the general fund and the healthcare access fund because they affect all the healthcare programs. From a more global perspective, this fund balance reflects about $96 million in spending reductions to the fund. Those are offset by $61 million in new spending in this fund. The majority of which is an extension of the statewide health improvement program at the Department of Health. That's $40 million for the biennium. The difference that makes up the total reductions of 152 in the fund are actually related to transfers between the Health Care Access Fund and the General Fund. As Mr. Leitz pointed out earlier, at the end of the legislative session last year, some large transfers out of the fund into the general fund were done in order to pay for the early expansion of Medicaid for adults without kids at a time which there were resources available in the fund to do those levels of transfers. In the February or the November forecast made it so that those resources weren't available to the extent they were at the end of session, and so to balance the fund, we're reducing that transfer out that was in law at the end of session.
And so, Ms. Vogt, so the $48 million from 2013 is not made, nor is the one from 2014. Is that what you're talking about?
The $48 million is a transfer. It's under Statute 16A, 724, that we do every year. And basically what the governor's budget reflects is trying to read the two pieces of law about the transfers together, reducing the MA expansion transfers and also restoring the transfer that's in law under 16A.
In 2015?
In 2013 and 2014.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you those are reinstated.
Yeah, those understand. Are reinstated.
Oh, because they were, I got it. And so leaving with a net of $2 million in 13, because it was a $150 million deficit. So at least the fund is now healthy based upon all this. So,
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, and to either one, you're developing a large surplus in 2015 in the Healthcare Access Fund. Are you taking into account the possible transfer of people from Minnesota Care into the federal reform, or are you ignoring the federal reform?
Ms. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, this fund balance is based on a November forecast, which did take into consideration that adults without kids would be in Medicaid starting in 2014 under 133% of the poverty level. So you'll see starting in 2014 a structural balance is restored to the fund because of that reason. So there's more revenues than spending starting at that point because that's taken into consideration.
And Ms. Bolt, there'll be a current law updated this coming out in a couple weeks then.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So this fund balance will be updated to reflect the November or the February forecast in a couple of weeks here.
And so, members, this is welcome to the 201 or 301 level of this committee looking at this thing. This is good practice. If you understand this, you've really got a lot of the committee figured out. Questions about the Healthcare Access Fund at this time? This is helpful. I had another question. Questions about these last two sheets? I think we did pretty good. We're not done yet, of course. We have to invest four more minutes. And there actually might be time for a question yet. I just want to announce what's going to happen in the... Oh. Let's announce the packet of information. Oh, keep this in your folders unless you just want to study it at home tonight. This will be in your full book tomorrow. Tomorrow you're getting the whole thick book. Another tab's going to be there, do you think? From the... The Ventura tabs are coming from my staff, so that's nice. Just to give people a heads up, I think you guys were off the hook. Thank you very much for coming. Tomorrow we're going to hear from the Department of Health. And if the members will leave these little order forms that I want more information order forms with us now, tomorrow we're going to take questions on areas that were prominent. Tuesday, when you come back after a weekend away from these books, we're going to have long-term care discussions. We're going to talk about geographic rates. We're going to hear the Representative Fritz has a bill. We're hearing four bills that day, I think, on long-term care. If you have an interest in offering comments about this bill that the governor has proposed, I wanted to give the public that opportunity. And if you want to talk about it, I absolutely invite you to, not right now, but we'll do that on Wednesday and Thursday next week. We're also having House File 8 sometime next week. We'll just see how the demand is. If there's, four or five groups that want to testify, it'll be a little more relaxed. If there's 100, that'll be a different matter. But if you feel you need to say something, by all means do. But I want to encourage members to, understand this. Some of these things are going to be in the bill, so I don't know which ones, but do the math. And so those of you who are in study groups, not that this will be your target, but just think in terms of what a very well-intended department a governor brought here, given that he had a bunch of money to spend besides this. And so you got to think that they might be in our target. And so now your study groups have something of the mission you're going to go after. I would suggest your study groups look at these ideas here, accept them, reject them, say there's no way we're going to do this, or these kind of make some sense to me. If you're an interest group who cares about these line items and budget items, I would suggest you talk to our study groups in the next several days. If there's a minority report on a study group, you want to just give it to me directly. This is meant to be a positive exercise. And I do know in the topics that there are different political views about how you would go about doing this if one group or the other was in charge. The more collaborative we can make it, the better. There are limitations, obviously, to that. But I'm talking to everybody. But please don't come to my office and say, oh, you can't do that to me. I already know that you don't want me to do that to your particular group. What I want to hear from your groups is, how do we manage our way through this? The number makes sense. We can do it this way better. Half the number, we can do that and protect our clients. It's time for that. And I have had some groups come, but not as many as I was expecting by now. And in all that, you know, we have the time, the start button has been pushed for this topic. So that's Wednesday and Thursday. We'll be hearing testimony, a house file. Did that cover everything? And I want to thank you for your good attention, and we'll have questions tomorrow. So make sure you leave these things behind here. I want to thank the audience for their attention, and thanks to the department. We're adjourned.